Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Goodness, has this week been busy enough for you? Early in the week, we had that crazy dump of spring snow, and the week ended with shorts, flip-flops, MSU graduation, and Mother's Day. Whew. On a calmer note, the first calliope hummingbird of the season showed up at our house, along with a couple black bears, a few days ago. Our Desert Oracle Radio episode today was produced by Ken Lane, May 13th, 2022. If you are in real estate, I hope you don't see yourself in this one. Here is Real Estate Scoundrels and Flying Black Triangles.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. A sliver of silver moon hanging over the western hills. The quail are settling down for the night. Little bedtime conversations barely audible from beneath the Mormon tea bushes. I had a strange encounter the other day. Left me feeling real bad for a while. I was driving and this big red-tail hawk was swooping up from catching its dinner, a cottontail bunny. But the hawk was so low over the road that I had to stop to avoid hitting it. And the commotion, unfortunately, caused the hawk to drop the little rabbit, and I just felt like hell for everyone involved. The hawk likely went hungry, the rabbit likely died anyway. And as I was just at that moment driving away from home, it occurred to me that the redtail was almost certainly one of the pair that lives in a rare tall tree behind the radio studio. A couple years ago, last spring, the spring before, they all run together these past few years. I saved one of their youngsters who landed hard on his first attempt at flying down from that big tree. It was dazed, standing around the patio, and very quickly the ravens were on the roof, ready to kill it. How those ravens annoy the redtails. So I stayed out there with that Bigfoot young hawk for a number of hours. Running off the ravens whenever they came back. Eventually the young redtail got its wits again and perched on the bench with me for a while. Every time it got close, I'd move to the other end of the patio. Just a way of saying, I'm not your mother, buddy. And then I found a haven within a big tangle of salt bush beneath that tree. And a couple of days later, I saw it flying with his parents, doing all right. The cottontail, I realized, was most likely one of the many springtime bunnies that had quickly grown up as rabbits do. And the relatively protected refuge here, as the old fence keeps the coyotes out most of the time. Although they do like to gather and sing in the open desert just beyond the chain link. I bet it rattles those rabbits something awful. But they have carefree moments, especially when they're young, like all of us, I guess. Sometimes I'll just stand out there on a springtime evening watching three or four of them, each one about the size of a street taco, just having the most fun they'll ever have. Leaping over each other, chasing each other around. Surrounded by the fresh green shoots that'll shortly become weird weeds full of thorns and allergens. The primary weakness of a good moral cause is the people who support it. Our universal desire for happiness is at constant war with our universal urge to read the news. The more history you know, the less you're surprised by anything. Lifelong politicians always want your votes and your money so they can finally do that thing they've never done before. A pickup truck has two doors. Anything else is a sedan. Democracy is the only form of government where the leaders swear they've got no control over their own actions. Anarchy is the only form of government where everybody has to take responsibility for their actions. Never try to upload a large file after school gets out. We will never comprehend the depth of an animal's grief. Throw out any clothes you'd be ashamed to drop dead in. Remember that same Minerva is there for you, more or less. Blessed Saint Minerva, Queen of the Desert, patron saint of people who should know better, blessed receiver of the Saturday morning plea for mercy. Defender of the desert rats, protector of the chronic campers. Thank you. want to tell you a little bit about Yucca Valley. It gets a bad rap, this town. There are a lot of fly-by-night operators coming around here now. I mean, a couple of evenings ago, I walked out of La Palapa and a private jet misses my head by about a foot and a half. A private jet landing at the Yucca Valley airstrip. You see a lot of sketchy people driving around in cars that are too clean, too. Now, we only got a car wash around here a year or two back. They don't even do the insides. Now, there used to be one when it did the insides, but it was never open for more than a few weeks at a time. Consistently under new management. Checkered Flag Auto Salon, something like that. That old steel building is still there. I think it's a hot yoga studio now. Or a boutique, a place to get your costume for the weekend. You know, a Stevie Nicks dress, maybe a bola tie. Vintage hiking boots, some peacock feathers for your hat, etc. But this new one, this new car wash, it's one of those robot setups. A little more deluxe than the one over at the AMPM. But you do have to do your own vacuuming. Bring your own armor all. Some shop towels, some chamois. And it's never as good as the professionals do down at Cathedral City. And it's all useless anyway, because what are you going to do? Put carpeting on the dirt drive up to the house? The problem around here is not just the dust and the sand. It's these tiny rocks and small boulders you track into your vehicle. And good luck if you've got a dog. It's bad enough how the dog leaves half its hair on the passenger seat every time you go for a 10-minute trip through the drive-thru. To get the roll taco special for yourself and a carne asada burrito for your canine companion. But all the sand and the decomposed granite and the sundry other road construction materials a dog manages to bring into the car, just jumping in and out, it defies gravity, it defies physics. So you know when somebody pulls up outside your place on a Saturday morning in a late model Lexus with shiny tires. Well, you know they're up to no good. The Mormons never jump the fence, I'll give them that. The slick characters are all over town now, knocking on doors, bearing business cards. Ma'am, would you like to be freed from the aggravation of home ownership, all cash, right now? We can drive you over to the Wells Fargo and print out a banker's check. Why, you can take it over to the Walmart and they legally have no choice but to give you the money right then and there. Even if they have to walk up and down till they find an open checkout line to rate for $10 bills. And you can trust me, ma'am, this will be more money than you've ever seen or even heard about. What are you going to do with so much house anyway, here in your 87th year? And forgive me for knowing that, I just happened to look it up on the title to the house. Down at the courthouse in San Bernardino, of course. See, what we're going to do, we, my associates and I over in Beaumont, well, we're going to do all the work for you. No need to paint, no need to upgrade those appliances, no need for a five-room, high-efficiency, mini-split system. None of that is your problem anymore, ma'am. We'll do the remodeling. We'll get rid of the mold problem. Bring in somebody to zap the rats under the roof. And just think about the life you have ahead. You could move to Florida, live in a brand new condo tower looking down at the beach. Boy, you'll sure see those hurricanes when they're coming. It's a beautiful sight, I'm told. I got an ex-great-grandmother out there in Boca Raton myself. So they get her out and they do a two-week remodel. Maybe they turn around and sell it for $200,000 more than they paid the original owner, who moved in with her late husband in July of 1980, first street in town with natural gas. Or maybe they turn it into a party weekend rental for bachelorette celebrations. Private catering, always available with advance notice. Or those divorce parties, which is the kind of party most people have these days if they have parties. The younger people are too scared to get married. And the middle-aged people never figured out how to make it work. So people give it a hard time, the Yucca Valley scene, such as it is. But there's an old high desert town here, too, little bits of it anyway. There's still a swap meet with a breakfast diner inside, red plastic Helvetica letters on the menu board. There's still a builder's supply and a used tire shop, even if inflation has pushed those threadbare radials up to $35 per. There's still a bar or two where tourists are scared to go and the ex-Marine doorman breaks up a couple of fights a night. And there's a lady with a flaming red version of that hair metal style from about 1989. And she sort of ship deck lurches around the pool table. There's still a diner on the highway with a protein plate on the menu, cottage cheese and all, and the owner calls you honey even when you linger too long. When the quiet post-lunch hour fades into the senior special dinner crowd. What's in it this evening? Roast turkey with all the trimmings? So what if it's almost summer? Iced tea for the included beverage, please. And don't forget the lemon slice. Need my vitamin C. Nothing ever changes completely. It's just a long, slow slog that occasionally gets a little frantic, even if most of the pieces aren't moving at all. Come August, it'll be 110 and the crowds will be thin. And it's just you and me and the rattlesnakes in the shade of the recycling bin. A scorpion skittering across the kitchen floor while you're perched under the swamp cooler vent, reading a book by yourself. Cold sweat running down the sides of the beer bottle. Get thee to a desert place, so said the Lord Jesus so long ago. And you sure did. This is Desert Oracle Radio. With soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Let's try to open up the Desert Oracle mailbag here, and hopefully I won't be crushed like one of those hoarders in their self-storage unit. Dear Desert Oracle, I'm not going to bury the lead here. I saw something the other night, something in the night sky over Los Angeles. And of course, I left my phone upstairs in my apartment. In fact, for some unknown reason, before heading downstairs to take the dogs out that night, I had a loud and persuasive thought. Don't bring your phone outside. Why do you always have to have your phone with you? So for possibly the first time ever, I took the dogs out without my phone. I wore a headlamp instead, you know, for nighttime dog-related purposes. It can be quite dark in the 10-foot space between my apartment building and the next one. This glorified dog run opens up to a decent patch of sky. I've made it a habit these last 6 years to spend a few seconds or minutes every night looking up. Not really looking at anything in particular, I just look, take in the 5 or 6 stars bright enough to punch through the haze. Well, it finally happened. And if I had not been staring straight up into that tiny patch of night sky, I would have never noticed it. Flying in a straight line, it entered my field of view. Low, slow, and silent. It was a craft of some sort, V-shaped. Its body was dark, but somehow took on the color of the sky behind it. But what really stood out were 7 or 9 cream-colored nodes on its underside. These nodes could perhaps have been lights, but if they were, they were not illuminated. This thing was flying in dark mode. I was so overtaken, and it was moving so slowly. Then I remembered I was wearing that headlamp. So, aiming my face at the craft, I turned on the light, and the nodes reflected back ever so slightly. It did not slow down or speed up or change course or send me a message as I was hoping, but at least I confirmed I wasn't hallucinating. 400 or 500 feet up, moving in a straight line southwest to northeast over Highland Park. It wasn't a plane, helicopter, drone, meteorite, birds, or Starlink launch. I've seen all these things with my own eyes, and this was something else entirely. Strangely enough, nearly 40 years ago, my parents witnessed the infamous Hudson Valley UFO while driving home one night. They pulled over and caught the engine, another silent V-shaped craft. My parents were both pilots at the time, and my dad was a pilot instructor. They still say they have no idea how a craft that big could fly that slow, that low, all the while producing no discernible sound. Could I have seen the very same craft 40 years later on the other side of the country? Whatever it was, I can safely say to you now, I cannot explain it. Signed, Ellis in L.A. Well, thanks for sending this, Ellis. These are strange experiences, and it really doesn't matter what anyone else has to say about it. The effect it has on a person is generally deep and lasting. And the more comfortable you are with some mystery in life, the less you'll try to fit it into some mental box learned from the TV or a church or the UFO chat room or a New Age book. When my eldest son was still very young, maybe 7 years old, he was outside riding around on his bicycle on the dirt road in the twilight. He described what he saw, and he drew a picture of it that I still have all these years later. It was dark gray in color, and it had the shape of an isosceles triangle or a carpenter's square. Dimly lit circles in a line on either side, and it passed low over the foothills, east to west. Silent, eerie, the usual terms people use when they find themselves underneath one of these phantoms. What tends to lock these memories in our mind is a preceding event, a hunch, a portent. For him, it was the appearance of a large, glittering green beetle on his index finger. He lifted up his finger to take a look. And the thing in the sky was right there. Boy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I'm your host, Ken Lane. With soundscapes composed and performed by our own Red Blue Black Silver. Broadcasting on Friday nights at 10 p.m. from our base station in Joshua Tree. And at various times across the Southwest and beyond on good community stations, but let's not be too precious about it. I know most of you listen on your phone device. The $1,000 evolution of the $10 portable radio. If you happen to be listening to the podcast preview of tonight's show, listen, friends, we are doing a very rare high desert public appearance May 13 out at my favorite bar and grill, the Palms Restaurant in Wonder Valley, Friday the 13th. We would not have it any other way. 10 p.m. on the outdoor stage. It's the, I don't even know what these letters mean, ASEDR Festival. About 24 musical performances, including Red, Blue, Black, Silver live on stage with me. And probably a bunch of old radios or whatever we drag up there. Car batteries, spotlights. You can find us online at desertoracle.com. 5 years of radio shows, a couple of things for sale. You can support the show however you like. For instance, you can pick up the Desert Oracle Volume 1 paperback at bookstores everywhere. We are anxiously awaiting those royalty checks. They should be here about 2027. Sleep tight. Don't let the centipedes bite. Good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you're listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGBM Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. It's time for some readings about our birds and seasons. From Nature One Day at a Time by Kathy Katz. For May 11th, she writes, up to an inch long, carpenter ants are larger than most of the common North American ants. They typically live in dead wood, trees, houses, or under soil, burrowing in chambers made by excavating wood, but not eating it as termites do. The nests are orderly and well-constructed, housing battalions who provide regurgitated food for their queen. Like most ant colonies, workers and soldiers are part of the ant caste, but are wingless because they have no need to fly. Males and fertile females who need to leave the nest to mate are the only members with wings. As in other ant species, carpenters have a complex communication system of chemicals that describe news of the day. Cockroach approaching. Juicy wounded caterpillar behind rock. Fire ants closing in from the south. And then she closes with a quote that was from Bert Holdobler and Edward O. Wilson in Journey to the Ants. And they say, ants, like humans, to put it in a nutshell, succeed because they talk so well. The entry for May 12th begins with a quote from Diane Ackerman in A Natural History of Love. And she writes, whether her lover is Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now, they require romance to feel properly aroused. They are haunted by life. They are a ventriloquist's dummies. Breed, their body's command. Pass on your genes. They gaze into each other's eyes, their mouths open, and they sigh, I love you. And then the entry begins with, loving qualities have been attributed to mourning doves because of their lovey-dovey behavior. Mutual preening, kissing, pairing off, staying together through nesting, all have the attributes that humans consider a loving nature. Males are constantly heard coo-cooing to attract females during courting. Mourning doves have more broods than other neighborhood birds, up to 6 per year. Their nests are loose, almost non-existent arrangements of a few twigs thrown together as if they couldn't be bothered wasting time with building. They even eat on the run, cramming seeds in a storage area in the throat, called a crop, for later digestion. And then she closes with another quote. And this one is from James Elkins in The Object Stares Back. And he writes, love is all a calculated pursuit. Some people spend their lives searching like detectives among all the faces and bodies they can find. But as lovers say, it's not always so easy to know who catches whom, and looking happens in both directions. And next, from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant, for May 11th, 1853, Thoreau writes, how many little birds of the warbler family are busy now about the opening buds while I sit by the spring. They are almost as much a part of the tree as its blossoms and leaves. They come and give it voice. And then May 12th, 1850, Thoreau wrote, I too revive as does the grass after rain. Well, all those lovely singing little birds and mourning doves and carpenter ants, it's all a part of the season and the place here, too. Another part of the season here is the full moon this week. It's May 12th, and it's the flower moon. The appearance of flowers in abundance inspired the name for this moon, a term used by Algonquin and Ojibwe peoples. From what I can find online, our Montana indigenous peoples also call this the time of the flower, or budding moon. Similarly, the Cree names of budding moon and leaf budding moon celebrate the awakening of plant life. Egg-laying moon and frog moon are other Cree terms for this period. Moon of the shedding ponies is an Ogallala term. Planting moon from the Dakota and Lakota marks the time to plant seeds and start the year's crops. I hope you're able to get out and enjoy the full moon this week. I think we might have some clear skies for it, but you just never know. Anyway, as Mother's Day and Nurses Week wrap up, I want to introduce you to two remarkable women. Rebecca Walsh and her team have led more than 50 epic backcountry trips, navigating trails all over the world. In 2014, she founded Hike Like a Woman to do this, and in late June 2022, produced her first of what would be 121 podcasts that begin with Hike Like a Woman-inspired topics. And recently, she extended that work to a podcast about navigating the trails, trials, and challenges of cancer. The other remarkable woman is Rebecca's mom, Susan Connell. You heard her talk about celebrating nurses last week on the show. Today, you'll hear Rebecca interviewing Susan, who tells a heartfelt story of mothers, families, births, and sometimes loss. I'll tell you where to find more information for both of these women following this interview, which was hosted and produced by Rebecca Walsh.
Years, over 220,000 births and countless stories. You're listening to the Montana Nurse Podcast, where my mom, Susan Connell, shares her most unforgettable experiences.
A mom that came into the hospital, it was in July, it was summertime. She came to the desk. I was the only nurse in labor and delivery. She came to the desk and she said, "Could you just check to see how my baby is?" She said, "We've come from Billings and the baby, I haven't felt the baby move since we left Billings this morning." And I said, "Oh, okay, I'd be glad to." She's adorable. We sit down, she lays down on the bed. I cover her up, pull up her sheet and pull up her blouse. And she has got just an abdomen that's roadmapped with stretch marks and she's had lots of pregnancies. And so I start listening because she's real anxious to hear her baby's heartbeat. So I start listening, put on the Doppler, and at 38 weeks, you find a heartbeat the minute wherever you put the monitor on, you're going to hear the heartbeat. She just lays there as I slowly slide that monitor around, top of her abdomen, bottom, side to side, and she just looks up and she's just going, "Oh God, no, please, no." And I just say, "Let me call the doctor. He'll want to do an ultrasound." And as I leave, she is just looking at the spotlight in the ceiling and she's just crying and praying. She's so, so upset. I went out to the desk, called the doctor. The doctor's on his way. I grabbed the ultrasound machine. I'm on my way back into her room to at least give her a little comfort or to talk to her, hold her hand. And her husband runs through the door, sees her crying, and just rushes over to her bedside and says, "Is it what we thought, hon?" And she said, "Yes. Is the doctor coming?" She looks at me. I said, "He's on his way." Well, the doctor arrives just a few minutes later, puts on the ultrasound machine, starts to scan, and just takes a deep breath and says, "I want to show you, this is your baby's heart. Stop beating." And so they look at the monitor, and then this primal cry that all mothers when their baby dies, that it just fills a room, and it's terrifying and awful. It's an awful, awful sound. And she just screams, and her husband just grabs her, and it's time. The doctor and I just walk out of the room, and the doctor says, "We're going to give you a few minutes." And yeah, we let them just talk and cry. And a few minutes later, I took in some ice water for her to drink and some juice for him, and said, "Whenever you're ready, the doctor would like to come and talk with you." And Bo says, "We're ready. We can talk now." And they're both laying on the bed, just clutching each other like a stone column. They're just hugging and clutching to each other. I go out and the doctor comes in and says to them, "Well, you can certainly continue to travel if you want. And when Cecilia goes into labor, you can stop wherever you are go into the hospital there and deliver your baby and continue on your trip, or stop there and decide what you're going to do further. Or you can start to head home if you'd like to do that and have your baby in Tennessee. I just don't know how long it's going to take before you're in active labor. She just says, oh, I just don't know that I can continue traveling.
Yeah.
And she says, well, the other option is you can stay here and we'll induce you. You're close to delivery. And the husband says, well, how long will that take? And the doctor says, well, you've had other babies before. How many children have you had? And she said, we have four daughters, and this is our son. And she said, so I think we'd like to stay here and deliver him here, and then we can go on and finish our trip, because the kids have been looking forward to this trip for a whole year. As a matter of fact, we asked our doctor if we could go on a trip, and he didn't recommend it. So was there anything that I did for so long that caused Bubba to die? I want you to hear me really clearly. No, there's nothing you did that caused this baby to die.
Yeah. This,
if you would have delivered at home or stayed home, this would have been the same outcome. Now, maybe after delivery, we'll find out why your baby died. But right now, we don't know.
Yeah.
And sometimes even after delivery, we don't know. We'll take a look and see if we can figure it out. Then said, I'll let you two decide what you want to do, and then we'll give you some time and space to talk, and then turn on your light when you're ready to let us know. So we go out to the desk, and the doctor starts writing, and I get lost in my thoughts, thinking, I wonder why sometimes things just happen like that. You have three or four, and I'd been the nurse for some of them. So it's kind of emotionally a challenge for me, because I feel so broken, so sad and so broken for these parents. Anyway, pretty soon, I'm so lost in my thought, the next thing I know, the doctor taps me on the shoulder. It says, Susan, it's time to go in. They're like, they've just turned on their call light. So we went in, and Bo said, we decided we want to stay here and have our baby, but we have a few questions for you first. And one of those is, how long do you think it'll take? And he said, I think maybe 12 hours, maybe 24 hours. I don't think it'll take a really long time. And then Bo says, and can you help us find a babysitter for our children?
Oh.
And he said, oh my gosh, they're still in the car. I've got to go get the kids out of the car. And I said, I can help you with that. Do you have any more questions for the doctor? Because he'll write orders, and then we can get this show on the road for you.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we don't have any more questions for the doctor. And the doctor then left, and I talked to them about babysitting, baby care. I said, how old are your children? And Bo said, well, they're 2 to 15. They're all potty trained.
That's awesome.
Yeah, 2 to 12. I can't remember exactly how old the kids were, but Bo said, I'm going to run out and get them from the car. And I continued to say that our chaplain at the hospital was really good at finding people to babysit kids in an emergency. Cecilia was really happy about that. And I just started getting IV going, and I was started the Pitocin to get her labor to start help get her into labor. And I was documenting while I could hear the drips dripping into the, and all of a sudden the door opens up, and four beautiful little girls came running into the one is two, and she runs to her mom and jumps up on the bed, and her mom just snuggles her close, and it's like they hadn't seen each other for years. It was the sweetest. And the other girls come in and line up, you know, by their mom's bed, and dad sits down beside her on the bed, and he puts his hand on her leg, and Cecilia says, girls, we're going to deliver our baby here. And they said, oh, our baby's going to be born. And they said, yes, yeah, he's going to be born, but he's not alive. He's died. And the girls start crying, especially the girl who's 15. She says, oh, mom, what happened? And she said, we don't know. Yeah. And then we'll continue our trip, and we'll go to Disneyland. We're still going to have a really good trip. And the beau sits down, and he hands the girls all tissues, or he's sitting and he has tissues to all the girls while they're crying. And the oldest daughter, who's 15 and a lot like you, she said, mom, what can we do? How can we help? How can we help you? because the mom, they could see that she was sad too. And she was very, very quiet for a minute. And then she said, you could sing me a song.
Oh, geez. The Sound of Music moment.
The girl said, yeah, we could do that. What do you want us to sing? And the mom said, well, why don't you start with How Great Thou Art? So she says, now, Missy, you jump down. You get off the bed and you stand there with your sisters. And Bo helps the little two-year-old off the bed. And she marches. She stands, takes up the end of the line. And they arrange themselves, oldest to youngest. And they're standing and singing. Or they start singing. The mom gives them the pitch. And the girls just break into this beautiful, beautiful singing voices, and they just sing, and I just get tears in my eyes watching them until they break into harmony. It's beautiful. Like, the two oldest girls had harmony parts, and it was just incredible. And I thought, this is really a sacred moment. I just need to let them be as a family. So I snuck outside the door, and I just pressed my ear to the door because I wanted to hear them sing. And I motioned for the other nurses had come in. We had another patient had come into another room. So another nurse was there, and I pulled her over and I said, their baby just died. And so they're singing to their mom, and they all listened, and we all just kind of had a moment of crying there. And then after they were done, I went into the chaplain had arrived. And so they sang 4 or 5 songs, just singing songs of hope and praise and thanks. And I'm thinking, wow, such wonderful resilience in such a hard time for this little family. Chaplain came in and he said, I'm going to take you girls to my house. My wife is making beds right now, and she's going to fix a nice dinner for you. And you're going to come home with me if that's okay. And the dad and mom said, yeah, that'd be wonderful. I said my goodbyes at the end of the day. She hadn't gotten into active labor yet, but they were really coping beautifully as a couple, and thinking about what could have been or what would have been if this baby hadn't died, and thinking about having a son. And then the next morning, I come back to work, and my best friend Adrian had been their delivery nurse during the night, and she said, I've already said my goodbyes to them, but they want to see you, Susan. They're looking forward to seeing you again. And the dad is going to be in. The pastor's coming in with the kids in a couple of hours. He'll be here by 10. So I went in the room, and she showed me, you know, she just immediately said, this is a heavyweight. Be prepared. So he weighed 8 pounds, 13 ounces. A big, beautiful baby. He looked, but he was born with a knot, a true knot in his cord that was tied taut tightly. And the mom said, I was so glad to know that it wasn't anything I did that killed him. I just was so glad that there was evidence, that there was a reason that this baby died. It wasn't something that we couldn't tell. The baby didn't have to be autopsied to find a reason, which some parents don't choose to have anyway, but I don't know if they would have or not. But the girls came in, and cute little girls, they gathered around, and the mom said, do you want to hold him? And they passed the baby around, and the mother unwrapped him so they could count his toes and count his fingers. And then Cecilia said, this is really going to be fun. She said, I've got a surprise for you. And she opened up the baby's diaper. She said, a peanut. The oldest girl said, I was hoping I'd get to see what it looked. It was very, very, very bittersweet. They sang Happy Birthday. They named him Paul instead of Bubba. They said his name was Paul now, and they all said their goodbyes, and they wrapped the baby back up, and the mortician came to take the baby, and he was going to fly the baby home to Tennessee, to their town, and he would be there when they got back from their trip. And then when they left the hospital, I walked her out later that day to go on the trip, and as we were walking, I said, Are you guys professional singers? Because you sing so beautifully. And she said, no, no, but we don't have TV. And so we sing a lot in our house. And as they put her in her car door and shut the door, and as the car turned to drive away, the little girls in the back seat turned, and they were looking back at the hospital. Aww. I was waiting, and they were looking at the hospital where they left their little brother. Good story. I told you the whole thing.
Do women typically know when their child has passed away before they even, can they sense, do you think women can sense when they lose a child?
I don't think at the moment of death, but the babies oftentimes, like a lot of people as they're dying, they will rally for one last big breath of air or move or get active, get up and do something and then lay back down and pass away. So there's some literature that babies have a herald kick or something that's very strong before they pass away. And if we knew when that kick was coming, we'd get to the hospital, but we don't know. Babies, depending on how far how far a pregnancy is. But I think moms, once they don't feel the baby move, I don't think there's necessarily a premonition that a baby's dying or not doing well. Although there are stories in this book where there was a mom with twins that had no reason to come to the hospital. She had no reason at all. She just had a funny feeling, and she got to the hospital and her baby's heart rate, both babies, their heart rates were in the 60s. And it was just a matter of, when we heard that, to get them into a C-section really fast. Baby had an Apgar of 1, a very slow heartbeat. 10 is a perfect Apgar, but 1 is very poor. But the baby was resuscitated, and this mom, when I wrote the story and sent it to her, it was not twins. This gal went on to college, has her master's degree, and was resuscitated and just did beautifully. But it was an intuition from a mom that got her to the hospital, and maybe the baby was just moving a little differently, or there was something about the pregnancy that made her think it's different than it was before, or different than it was yesterday. So we were lucky, really lucky on that one.
I'm also thinking about her husband, because I think a lot of husbands would have been like, come on, there's nothing wrong. Like, this is just going to be a stop that's going to put us behind schedule.
Yeah.
He must have had a really...
I think even sometimes when women are in labor and they think, I need to go to the hospital, a husband will say, let me just do one more thing, or let me... Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thought.
How did you, when you came home after seeing that dead baby, how did you recover mentally enough to go back to work the next day? And do you just bounce back, or do you keep thinking about it every time you walk past that room? Or I guess I'm just curious.
That's an interesting thought. How do you care for yourself? Well, two things. When I was in that delivery, when I heard that there was a true knot in the cord, I could have been Cecilia, because Eric had a true knot in his cord.
Yeah. Eric's my brother.
Yeah. So it made me think how blessed I was that I didn't have to go through the loss of a baby.
Yeah. So you were feeling, you were feeling grateful that this could have been you a decade earlier.
Yep.
And then you were about to say another feeling you were having.
So every time a baby with a true knot in the cord is born, it just brings me back to the doctor saying to me, look at this. If this was any tighter, this would have been a dead baby.
So that's a trigger.
Me. Yeah. So I was, yes. And then I think as a nurse, you learn to
compartmentalize. That's it. Compartmentalize.
Yeah. Compartmentalize. So we go from, occasionally, my manager was really good and she allowed me to have one patient. But sometimes in an emergency, you'll have a patient that has a baby that has died that you're laboring with, and a patient is delivering a live baby. So you have to leave that sadness in the room and read the room, be happy for this couple that are delivering their first baby or their 10th labor. Yeah. But so you learn how to do that in nursing somehow. I remember a doctor going into a patient that was about to have a live baby after coming from a baby that he had just delivered, and he told this family that he'd just come from this room. And I remember how it just, the family and the couple that he was talking with, it just rained on their parade so much. The doctor just, he kind of wanted to explain why he was a little late getting to their delivery, but it was difficult for them. And then they were, throughout the hospital stay, they were saying which ones were the ones. They really wanted to comfort them, which was kind of a sweet thing.
Yeah.
But the parents just stayed overnight and then left the next day. But I was saying, I don't know that everything happens for a reason. But I think as human beings, we try to say that to ourselves so we can find the good out of whatever happens to us. We're human, having human experiences. And we're going to have all kinds of things happen to us in this life. And for me, I just am so grateful that I come home to a family that's loving and kind. I don't have a husband that's going to beat me or hurt me in any way, but he's going to envelop me in his arms. I don't know. Did I tell you this? Do you remember this story when you were a little girl? Do you remember this happened? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was able to tell my family.
I just don't think we realized how cool your job was, how important your job was, or what you went through every single night.
Yeah. Well, that's
and probably, I guess maybe that's good.
True. I don't think you can. It was a job that it was a position. It was a joy to me. It was fun to go to work. I was tired sometimes, but
yeah,
it was really joyful, and it was a joy being at home with a mom. That was the hardest part, you know. How do you do both things that you love equally well? And, you know, there was always push and shove, I'm sure. I slept and missed more than I wanted with my children. I wasn't getting paid with my children. I was getting paid, but not financially. You know, it didn't pay enough for me to be a mom. So I had, but it paid off in the long run to be a mom, for sure. You know, if you fail, it feels bad for a lifetime. But if you have children that are successful and happy and well-adjusted and contribute to the world and communicate well, then life is a joy. And that's I've been blessed to see that with my children.
Thanks for listening. Follow along at SusanSconnell.com for details about her book release. See you next time.
You can find this and more stories about Susan's nursing experiences and the latest news of the book she has written at her website, SusanSConnell.com, and that's spelled SusanSConnell.com. You can find out more about Rebecca's upcoming trips at HikeLikeAWoman.com, and that's all one word, Hike Like a Woman. And you can find her podcasts, all 121 of them, under The Rebecca Walsh Show on popular podcast platforms. Well, as always, thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the good people that provided music or showed up to celebrate KGVM's birthday a couple days ago. Thank you, Old Farmer's Almanac, Susan Connell, Rebecca Walsh, and thanks to Steve Grant and Kathy Katz for our nature readings from their books. Thank you for listening. You can hear this program broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. Let's have a really sweet song from Jack Johnson to close us out today. I can't hear it without thinking about moms of all kinds. Here is Angel from Jack Johnson's album, Sleep Through the Static. See you next week.
She doesn't wear any wings. She wears a heart that can melt my own. She wears a smile that can make me wanna sing. She gives me presents with a presence alone. Gives me everything I could wish for. She gives me kisses on the lips just for coming home. She could make angels. I've seen it with my own eyes. You've gotta be careful when you've got good love, 'cause them angels will just keep on multiplying. You're so busy changing the world. Just one smile and you could change all of mine. We share the same soul. Oh, oh, oh.